You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Time for your view from the C-suite here on Classic Business, bringing you closer to the business leaders around the boardroom table, be they CEOs or founders, CIOs, chairs. What makes them tick? What keeps them up at night and gets them out of bed every morning and drives them to excel? Well, my next guest has a remarkable and improbable story. At the age of 12, he was about to drop out of school to become a farm labourer until fate stepped in. And I think his remarkable journey has taken him from the Free State to the hallowed halls of the University of Berkeley, California, and back to South Africa, where he became Captain of Industry and Investex CEO. Fani Titi, welcome to The View.
Hi, Michael. Good to be here.
Now, where did you grow up that saw you almost becoming a farm labourer? Not that there's anything wrong with honest salt-of-the-earth work, but certainly miles removed from the high-flying deal-making world of private equity and banking.
Yeah, I grew up in the Central Free State, the farming heartland of the country, a little town called Windburg. If you drive from Johannesburg to Bloemfontein, there's a little town about 100 kilometres away from Bloemfontein called Windburg. That's where my parents worked as farm laborers. And in the 60s, as you will know, the system of separate development, apartheid, was at its highest. And for somebody who found themselves on the farm as a black kid, your future was largely confined to working as a farm laborer. So the prospects were quite dim at that stage. Hope and ambition was quite limited. And as happens in life, doors open. And my dad at the time had a fallout with farmers in the area. And we ultimately left at the time that the apartheid government was separating black people on the basis of tribe. Being Sotho speaking, we were then moved out to the homeland of the Sotho's, KwaKwa, in the mid-70s. And that's where I got some education, got into high school. And really, that break was a critical break for me. I was able to get through to matric. At the time, my parents had no means whatsoever to take me to university. I was at the time thinking of becoming a teacher, but my matric results were particularly good, in particular in mathematics and physics. So I received a scholarship to study mathematics, physics, and applied mathematics at Fort Hare. Went through there to study, completed my BSc and my honors degree. And at that time, being part of a large family, had to again drop out to go work as a teacher to support my siblings as they also needed to go through school. And latterly got a Fulbright scholarship to study for a master's degree in mathematics at the University of Berkeley in California, as you said. Then returned to continue to teach at the University of the North, the KwaKwa branch. And after 5 years of teaching, I felt that my career was coming to a bit of a dead end. I had started to read for a PhD in mathematics, but felt that really that was not the career I wanted to have in life. I wanted to work with people and to work through people. So I detoured, as it were, into business, starting off given my mathematics background, with investment banking, joined RMB, our competitor now, in 1991, and then developed from there into an investment professional and ultimately joined the board of Investec. And here we are. I now have the role of chief executive of Investec.
A remarkable story showing how not only fate, but commitment and discipline towards education can take one almost anywhere in the world. I recall chatting to John Olifant, the former principal officer of the Government Employees Pension Fund, about how he managed to finish top of his class. Also, he hailed from a small town in the Free State, and he attributed much of his academic success to William Smith and watching a lot of William Smith on TV and going back and actually teaching not only his peers, but some of his teachers as well. But certainly comes through, Fani, in your story. It's fair to say that education was a lodestar for you and you were a teacher for some time. What do you make of the education crisis in this country 26 years into democracy?
Look, if the country is going to achieve its potential, we have to solve the education conundrum. As you say, in my own life, my life could have turned out very differently, but for the fact that I was able to get education. And by the way, I didn't get decent education. I had Bantu education until matric, went to Fort Hare, which in those days we called bush universities. So when I went to Berkeley, you could really see the gap in preparation and quality of education. So the time I spent there was really hard because I had to make up for the quality of education that I had. But it was still a reasonable education that allowed me to make progress. If you look at the World Economic Forum measurements on the quality of education versus the spend that we do spend on education, the quality of education is not what it should be. We should be doing better than countries like Zimbabwe and a lot of other countries across the world, because on a per capita basis, we spend a lot more. What is required, obviously, is to make sure that we have better teaching, we have a better environment of accountability. I think you have to get to a point where you measure the effectiveness of teaching, you make sure that teachers can be measured for performance, and that you measure quality of education on an international basis. The idea that you get to metric and that behind some black box that are either adjusted or that numbers of people who pass are increased. And you see when you get to university how much these kids struggle because the quality of education is quite poor. To compete on the global stage with China, with South Korea, with the Europeans, with the Americans, we have to have a much better quality of education. And as I say, it is not really a resource issue as opposed to a quality and an effectiveness issue. One of the potential solutions for improving the quality of education is introducing more competition. At the moment, the state is the predominant provider of education. If for the same cost that the state expends on a child, you provided, for instance, parents with vouchers to buy education from other providers, I think you would see that competition, firstly, getting more provision of education into the system, better quality education, and it would force the state to increase the quality of education. Otherwise, people would migrate from the state to the private sector. So at a philosophical level, I do believe the state has to open up to the possibility of increasing more significant competition into the education sector through a provision of funding. The Scandinavians and other countries do have a system of choice where the state funds education, parents have the choice where to spend their money. I think that's one of the ways we could quickly address the quality of education. But fundamentally, we've got to make sure that state schools work, they work better in terms of the education of teachers, the discipline around education, and the relevance of the education that the kids get. At the moment, thousands and thousands of kids come out of universities every year with education that is completely irrelevant to the needs of the economy at the moment. So there are a number of fundamental problems in the education system, but I do not believe they are beyond solving. I really do think that there are quick wins we could make. But one of the areas of decision for government is the balance between the power of the unions and the right of the child to a quality education. And I think the ANC government still has to address that particular tension.
Isn't that
cripples education?
Isn't that the inherent tension at so many of our seemingly intractable ideological debates that we have in this country, Fani? The decision that needs to be taken in the best interests of all South Africans to develop our human capital means that government and the ANC-led government needs to take a much firmer approach to one of its tripartite alliance partners in the form of Labour. Do you think we are significantly politically mature enough to open up that conversation now? And do you think that perhaps COVID-19 has forced government into a sort of moment of reckoning fiscally, purely on the numbers? We've borrowed up to our eyeballs, and we've got to get growth going at using any means possible. Do you think the ANC under the president is sufficiently courageous enough to have this conversation with Labour?
Look, I think we have run out of road physically. As you say, our debt to GDP is unsustainably high. With COVID, the revenue side of the equation will suffer a lot. There are numbers in terms of the shortfall in revenue that continue to come in because business activity has largely stopped. So with that as a cliff, what do we do as a country? We have to face up to the issues that confront us. I think there's a willingness in certain parts of government. If you look at the Treasury, as an example, as you know, they have entered into a renegotiation with the unions around the cost of employment in the state, because that cost creeps up and crowds out other parts of expenditure. You know, as we speak now, there's a dispute between the government and the unions because the government decided not to go through with increases that had been agreed priorly. So there's an area of courage. And by the way, I do not believe that it is necessarily the case that government should be anti-union. I think we can have a compact in the country where the right of workers are protected, where workers are rewarded fairly for the work that they do. But on the other side of the equation, we have to insist on productivity, we have to insist on effectiveness, and we have to insist on delivery of services. So if you get to better service delivery, you will be able to pay government employees better, have them better trained as well. But there are tough decisions that have to be made. As I say, the salary increase one is an interesting one, but the president has to lead from the front. We have no room anymore to wiggle. Otherwise, we will end up at the door of the IMF. And I know for this current government, the IMF is a no-no, but we will be left with no option but to go to Washington cap in hat.
And that is not where you want to find yourself. Chatting to some of the players in the listed property space, the REITs, while we've been sharing pain thanks to COVID-19, and the REITs are giving rental relief to some of their retail tenants. Some of the retail tenants have said that's not enough and they've pushed back. There's a squabble there. But I think even beyond that, any large mall owner will tell you that they've had to absorb swinging increases at a municipal rates level over the last 10 years, in excess of 500% over the last 10 years, well in excess of inflation. And it just can't continue like that forever, Fani. We're also seeing a lot of pain in the private sector, job losses. We don't do furloughs, but there's been a similar kind of approach at many firms. Retrenchment Section 189 notices given. And there hasn't been a similar sharing of earnings pain in the public sector either. So I think it's a very important point that you raise that. On COVID-19, this 200 billion rand guaranteed loan scheme, which is really a crucial centerpiece of this phase two economic response to the crisis, we're now sort of 1 month in. And if you look at the take up, it's been quite low. I think the numbers that I saw from Stuart Theobald reckon, according to their calc, maybe you've got a more accurate figure, but it's around about 2 billion rand or 1% of the scheme target. Why is that? This certainly is worrying if we're to see this scheme being effective. I have had some critique, some listeners to the show saying they find it curious that directors have to put personal surety up, considering it's a government-backed scheme. I've had some in the banking sector then come back to me to say, well, this is just to ensure that we're aligning interest here and there's still, you know, market discipline at play. Do you think we need to perhaps relook at the way this guaranteed loan scheme is structured and designed?
Look, just taking a step back, addressing a comment you made about sharing pain. I think in this time of crisis, you will find that the corporate and private sector will play its part in supporting the overall economic objective of keeping as many people employed as possible. And to this extent, the banks and Investec was a leading proponent and player in setting up the loan scheme as we have it, the loan guarantee scheme of 200 billion. And we will play a part in it. Part of it is that the conditions had to be universal to all the banks, because this is a scheme that essentially is guaranteed by government. So the arrangements, the loan agreements have been agreed on a uniform basis. And in implementing a scheme of this nature, there will be some teething problems. As an example, in the UK, where we have a significant operation, it also took quite a long time for the government support schemes to get off the ground. In the US, where the government put in trillions of dollars into the economy, even there, the initial take-up was quite slow. I do believe that certain aspects of the scheme may have to be looked at in terms of implementation. I have seen some small businesses in my private capacity struggle to access funding. Issues relating to guarantees can be a problem for small business owners. But I think the banking industry and the government are prepared to look at these on a case-by-case basis where it makes sense. Certainly, the scheme is meant to support industry and businesses through this period where there is a significant level of lockdown. There obviously will be businesses that would have been in trouble before COVID-19 hit. There will be businesses that will be unlikely to survive COVID-19 even with the scheme. So some of the complexities are because as a bank, even with the guarantee of government, you still have to try and make sure that you think the business will likely survive and have a higher probability of repaying. So the take-up is still low, but I'm hopeful that we can iron out some of the teething problems. As I say, it's not unique to South Africa. It happened in the UK, and we are a player there, and it also happened in the US.
Now, Fani, we're in the new decade, 2020. Some might quibble that 2021 was actually the start of the new decade, but effectively we're 10 years out from the goals of the National Development Plan. As a CEO of one of the country's most innovative and entrepreneurial and largest banks out there, where do you see South Africa in 2029? 9 years from now, we're 1 year out from the National Development Plan. All things being equal, and we've still got the Ramaphosa administration, where do you see this country?
As we said at the beginning of this interview, we are at a crossroads at the moment. Hard calls have to be made around a number of issues. There has to be structural reforms within the economy. We have to address fundamentally the problems of education. We've got to make sure that local government works as it should. We have to make sure the state is smarter. If I had my way, I would have a smaller but smarter state that creates an environment where the private sector and private initiative can come to the fore and help in delivery. But we are not at that point. The levels of trust between the private sector and the government is much too low for the government to pull back a little bit. We have to invest in infrastructure at quite a rapid rate. One of the areas of opportunity, obviously, is in renewable energy. This country has a lot of innovation, the capacity to fund. If we make the right choices, literally in the next couple of months, we can still achieve a level of growth, and we can still achieve most of the progress that we need to make. But it'll be difficult to reach the targets that the National Development Plan had set for 2030, given that over the last 5-7 years or so, we have had very anemic growth. So there almost is what the president calls the lost decade, as it were. So with that loss of time and opportunity, and the fact that you've got to restart the economy given where we are and where COVID-19 has taken us, it's going to take much more radical thinking, much more bold action, much more courageous action. And I think the ANC government and the president still have to move much more courageously, much more faster. By the way, we talk about 2030 in terms of the National Development Plan. At a global level, there is also another agenda, the 2030 Sustainable Development Goals, because at the end of it, economies are about taking care of the needs of the people. And from a world perspective, the United Nations had set out a number of goals around addressing inequality, addressing climate change, addressing provision of clean water, etc., etc. We are, even at a global stage, we are so far behind where we should be in terms of addressing these very major crisis that faced the world. So while in South Africa, we have our own problems, the world really has to wake up and up the ambition towards development. For us, we have the National Development Plan. For the world as a whole, we have the Sustainable Development Goals of 2030.
And we need to align those. And in that, Fani, I see a great opportunity. If you look at the abundant sunlight that we have in this country, the renewable energy resources we have, we talk about this just energy transition. JP Morgan came out yesterday that sits on the GISD along with Investec and came out with a note saying, two of the three major tipping points have been achieved in the fossil fuel industry to see us move into renewables. It's just a question of having that political will to steer us in that direction. Fani, a great pleasure chatting to you and sharing your rather remarkable journey from the small town in the Free State to being the CEO of Investec. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
That was Fani Titi, Investec's improbable CEO, sharing his unconstrained view from the C-suite. And that's also a wrap from the Classic Business team this week. Thanks to producer Andries Mkhlangu and sound engineer Matabataba Radebe. The Jazz Lounge with Rod Miller up next for you in Cape Town and in Gauteng. Richard Koch and the Full Works will hopefully keep you warm on another chilly Friday evening. Good night.